Hello, and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. This is the Reverend Laura F. Geddes, and I'm the Associate Rector at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Midtown Memphis, where I have the honor of serving as clergy for congregational engagement and development. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. on WYXR 91.7 FM, we bring community leaders near and far to come and discuss how faith has played a role in their lives. And I am thrilled to be here today with the Reverend Ayanna Watkins. But before we begin our conversation, we remember a saint who is not very well known. At least she was not well known to me. Her feast day comes up on August 27th, so I'm a little early. But this saint, her name is Gladys Elphick, and she was born in Australia in 1904. And Gladys Elphick was a young widow when she left the Aboriginal mission at Point Pierce in 1939 in Australia. And like many Aboriginal Australians, Elphick had been taken to a mission as an infant, part of the Australian government initiative of assimilation, in which Indigenous people were forced onto reserves and children of mixed descent were removed from their families. The group now is often referred to as the Stolen Generations. Elphick saw Australian Aboriginals outside the mission and saw so much abject poverty. Aboriginal soldiers who'd served in the war were ineligible for the benefits afforded to non-Indigenous veterans. A Family Endowment Act payable to mothers excluded the Indigenous population. And many Aboriginals worked 16-hour days, earning a fraction of what their European counterparts did. Gladys began to organize. She began to organize and invite tons of Indigenous women in the community to come meet at her home. And I love the nickname she came to have, Aunt Glad. And that's where they'd go, to Aunt Glad's home. The group wanted to show the community and also the government that they were to be taken seriously and had a voice and deserved to be at the table. And Gladys went on with this group to found the Council of Aboriginal Women of South Australia, which led to the establishment of medical and legal services that are still present in Australia today. Gladys's history was new for me, and a new saint, at least for me, to learn about, and particularly this summer. I'm mindful of our own country's reckoning with the Indigenous peoples here in America, and the ways our early country has sought and did seek out to assimilate Indigenous people into westernized white culture. This summer, I know I've heard, perhaps you have too, the stories of mass graves found near Native American boarding schools, schools where Indigenous children were not allowed to use their native language, only English, and where they were given new names, as well as not allowed to practice their religious and tribal traditions. This summer, I did some research a bit and also traveled west to Montana. And both of these things helped at least begin to better educate me on learning about our history, especially with Indigenous persons, even the role of our Supreme Court and how it has played its part towards assimilation in a legal way. I learned, too, that these persons were referred to as wards of the state. And there was such a focus on erasing Native culture. So I've been especially appreciative and grateful to know more about the life and work of Gladys Elphick, because I think learning about others' history, as well as our own country's history, helps us better know the ways we need to heal. And we can't heal if we don't know what we need to heal from. Today, I have the privilege and delight to be joined with the Reverend Ayanna Watkins, who is the lead organizer for MICA, which stands for Memphis Interfaith Coalition for Action and Hope. She grew up in Chicago and came to Memphis in 2014. And I can still remember it was upon a fairly recent, she had fairly recently come to Memphis, and we got to know each other at a coffee. You remember that, Ayana? In Crosstown. Micah was beginning its journey in some really exciting ways. And we had some pretty authentic conversation then. I have gone on to connect in some ways through being partners at St. Mary's Cathedral, where I served before I was at Grace St. Luke's. And if I can say this too, I also have the wonderful opportunity to serve with your husband on the board with the Lynching Sites Project.
That's right.
Yep. So it's wonderful to be together with you in the studio today.
Thank you, Laura. It's good to be here with you.
Yeah. So will you tell us a little bit about growing up, your childhood, and what was your spiritual life like, your concept of God, all of how that kind of shaped you, stories you want to share?
Sure, sure. So again, it's great to be here and to be with you and just have a chance to not just reconnect with each other, but to continue to share the story of this great work we get to do together. So I'm thankful to be here. So I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, after having been born just outside Chicago. My parents are divorced. And so I had two families raising me at any given time. And that matters because Memphis Interfaith Coalition is not without meaning in my own life. My own family came to be interfaith as well. So my mom was raised in a generations of Christians, Christian family. And my dad is the son of a super spiritual Christian woman who was ostracized from her home church. She never gave up her faith in Christianity and her practice of Christianity, I should say. Never gave up her faith in God. She did not give up her spiritual practice of Christianity. But her children, all eight of them, made multiple different decisions, right, from that pain that they witnessed in their mom and the way that the church treated her. And so my dad was one of the siblings who decided that Christianity was not for them and found a new faith community that practiced a comedic spirituality. For those who aren't familiar, it has some origins in Egyptian spirituality, but also brings in multiple other influences from China and different parts of Africa and other places. So it becomes sort of the syncretism. I'm using all my seminary words today, Laura.
Right on.
this syncretism of a practice that really, as I was growing up, because I was quite young when my parents split up, really gave me multiple visions into what faith could look like, what faith communities look like. And I had very intimate relationships, I would say, like, with each of those experiences. Mm-hmm. So part of what it meant for me to grow up with a single mom is that my mom's church community became my family. I didn't have one dad. I had five dads and 85 uncles and aunties and grandmas and grandpas who literally raised my brother and I.
Sounds like community became family.
They just wrapped us up. There was no question. They had already raised my mom. And really, to some degree, they'd already raised my grandmother. Mm-hmm. We had been in that church since my great grandmother was a baby or in that community. And so when we came back from Chicago, reforming our family unit, the church just wrapped us up and took good care of us. And at the same time, knowing that my father had made a choice for a different faith community after the pain he experienced from the church, I was clear that church was not, church wasn't good in this sort of homogeneous way, right? It wasn't de facto right for everyone. And it did not de facto work well everywhere and all the time. And so I became very clear that faith is a choice. And I think sometimes when we grow up in the church, we forget that, right? We inherit this faith. Mama had practiced it, daddy practiced it, grandma practiced it. And here I am, I'm just here. But at some point we make the choice for ourselves that this is also going to be our way of life, that this is going to be what we believe. And I had literal choices to make, right? Was I going to be part and belong to this faith community that my dad was in, or that my mom and I ultimately, you know, made a decision, I made a decision for Christ. I made an active decision for Christ. Mm-hmm. And I like to remind people that, right? I had options. So I take my faith very seriously, and not for granted because of that upbringing.
Yeah.
But I also honor that people make other choices, right, with what's laid in front of them. And so I feel like we're blessed to live in this plurality of people who have made all these different choices around how they understand God and what they're going to believe. And I honor the wrestling that people have to do to get there, or the courage that it takes to have those convictions and then act on those convictions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So for me, that's part of the road that brought me to Micah, right? That if I'm going to choose this path, if I'm going to choose Jesus, then what does that look like to walk in those shoes, to wear that name, Christian? And for me, that means to work for the abundant life that Jesus came to make possible for us all. It's for me to honor the dignity of every human being, regardless of circumstance, race, class, because that's what Jesus did when he was here. Mm-hmm. And to fight for justice, because that was important to Jesus. It was important that folks be treated justly. It was important that we were responsible to each other as community, that it wasn't just about me and mine. But that what we did was important to all. I've long wrestled with when, the Christian Bible story, when people are telling Jesus, hey, your mom and your brothers are looking for you, right? Mm-hmm. And what does he say? Like, my mom, my mothers and brothers.
They're right here. They're here. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And that sense of part of this journey being expanding your family. And I'm here, right? Because my church family expanded their family for me to fit me in. It's literally the least I can do.
I can really, really see those connections around your childhood and growing up and the connections to Micah. That's a beautiful journey of connections and community and passions. That's really powerful, Ayanna. That really is. We should probably talk a little bit about Micah so that others who maybe are hearing for the first time, when we're talking about it being interfaith and a coalition for action, hope, what we mean by that. So could you tell us a little bit about how it got started? It's three pillars, its purpose, and Grace St. Luke's is honored. We began to be a partner. It's been a year now, a partner. Wow. With Micah, and got three delegates, and we just had our return meeting last night, it's been a journey already. So I want to spend some time with us talking about Micah. So a little bit of history, maybe we'll be
sure,
good.
Sure. And I'm excited to hear about your progress, and we're excited to be working together. So Micah, Memphis Interfaith Coalition of Action for Action and Hope, came from an initial meeting in October of 2016 in the basement of St. James AME Church here in Memphis. About 12 clergy there, mostly African American, who were coming together after what had been the summer protest in Memphis that shut down the I-40 bridge.
That's right, the bridge protest.
And the clergy, that's right, and that was against police brutality. Mm-hmm. Here and elsewhere. And it was such an important moment. And I think a lot of clergy felt like, what's the best thing for me to do now? Like, how do I be clergy with the most authenticity and integrity in this environment? What's my role? What's my lane? And so we came together and we were talking about that. We were joined by a pastor from Nashville who had started an organization a few years back in Nashville that was also an interfaith coalition that was working for justice in their city. And we said, you know, as we were talking, he offered his model and the national network he was a part of, which is the Gamaliel Network based out of Chicago, that, you know, if we wanted to become an affiliate of something that already exists, or if we want to start our own thing, you know, we had those options. And so we eventually, we looked into the model and decided, let's try it. Let's see if it'll work here. And from that meeting of 12, we eventually had 200 people meeting just a few months later.
I was at some of those meetings that came
in between.
Yeah. Evergreen and bring in a friend, you know, bring that's 10 right. And you know,
that's how you get from 12 mm-hmm. to 200.
That's right. That's
everybody
right.
has to bring somebody.
That's right.
Right. And it did feel like, you know, again, back to the biblical story of the 12 disciples going from 12 to 72, right?
Right, right.
And that sense of just continuing to bring people along. And I think the timing was right. Folks have heard me say this a lot, 1,000 times, but it's because I believe it. I believe that social justice is always happening. Movements are always being built and growing and stretching out. But there are windows, right, in the social fabric that open up from time to time. There are windows in this era we live in that open up when the whole community feels the buzzing, the vibe, recognizes that we're in a special moment and we can all move. Everybody's courage starts to collectively lift, right? Mm-hmm. And we hit the streets, or we hit the bridge, or we come out of our individual, you know, sort of bubbles and say, wait, this thing is bigger than me. What can I do? And so I really felt, you know, October 2016 was one of those windows, right?
Yep.
We just had an election, or we were up on the eve of a critical election that shifted our country and the realities that folks were facing. Just a few months ago was the protest on the bridge. And so it was a thick, vibrating moment in Memphis. And Micah was born in that moment. Mm-hmm. So I do think timing mattered there. We continue to grow. We did what we call one-on-ones, which are the building block of our work. We believe that justice and change and equity happens one conversation at a time, one relationship at a time. And we build power by building our relationships.
And from that time of these conversations, the one-on-ones, I mean, there was structure put in place. I was really struck by that.
That's right.
Structure almost came first before even, actually, it didn't almost, it came first mm-hmm. because structure in place, we knew that there were going to be plenty of initiatives and need, and it was going to be a matter of what were those needs going to be and how we're going to decide. We can't mm-hmm. do that without a structure. So putting
right.
that structure in place, then we were able to begin to have those one-on-ones, those conversations to see where these three pillars that have really become to, you know, shape and focus our group's, you know, energies and areas where they want to make justice and, you know, are known, came to be.
Yeah. And I don't want to, I want to put those two things we were just talking about together, right? The structure next to the building of relationships through the one-on-ones. We did over 2,000 one-on-ones in that period between late 2016 and early 2018. 2,000 separate conversations to find out where people's hearts were, what was in their gut, what they really cared about. And then we had the blessing of being handed this structure, this model that we could build off of. And I was part of that structural work. I was voluntold to be part of, to be co-chair of the structure team. Mm-hmm. And that was what I was doing professionally. I was helping nonprofits get off the ground. And so I said, well, I can do that. And so we put together bylaws and we put together leadership structures and we put together policies that would create our culture of working. And like you said, with those 2000 conversations, we then began to organize first a sort of a charter community. We had a covenanting ceremony where we decided, you know, the first 40 or so groups that signed on that we would be MICA. And then a few months later held our first issue convention where we would choose collectively, and we used the caucus model and it was super fun, choose collectively what good work we were going to do, narrowing our decision from 10 things we had heard from those many thousands of conversations down to the three pillars you referenced before. And those pillar issues are economic equity, education equity, and race and class equity in the justice system. So those are our core issues. Sometimes the word pillar might be a little bit misleading because there is some room for movement there as the world changes, as things evolve, as folks, things happen and folks move to new places. We can continue to revisit our issues and figure out if we need to choose new pillars. But we choose those pillars believing that we can live on those for several years before we need to revisit. So that's the work that we're doing. That's the arenas that we've decided on to work together. There's been a little bit of evolution in the race piece. For those who were there in the early days, you'll remember that it was originally immigration and intercultural equity. But we learned a lesson that a lot of nonprofits have also learned beside us, which is it's tough to fight immigration at a state and local level. Yes. Much of the work, transformational work that happens at the federal level. And so we've shifted our work in immigration to more inclusivity and really looking at racial equity to deal with the ways that immigration impacts all of the work that we do. How racial equity becomes a factor in everything that we're working on in education and economics and the justice system. So that's a short, limited version of how we got to those three pillars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's more to say about those one-on-ones because they continue. I mean, they're an integral part about hearing where folks are, for example, like at Grace St. Luke's, where folks are with their energies, what keeps them up at night, where they're finding hope, and really get to the heart of where energy is, where there is power that can be harnessed and utilized. And so that different congregations, different nonprofits, you name it, because it's groups, it's not individuals that make up the partnerships. You can't come as an individual, right? But you can be a partnership. Mm-hmm. But those one-on-ones are so relational in getting to know another, and you're intentionally supposed to reach out to folks that you don't know and connect. There's a lot of power behind those. Will you say a little bit about those? And let's talk some about power, shall we?
And about power as well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So the one-on-ones are a tool, but they are a tool to build power. And we do that through relationship, which is a little bit oxymoronic for a lot of folks in sort of their, in our thinking. Certainly it was for me. One-on-ones feel very sort of personal and not a public move, right? But when we build relationships with folks, especially those who aren't in our bubbles, aren't already in our circles, our mind expands, but also our heart expands. Also, that fire within us begins to grow. We feel compassion, we feel anger, we feel frustration and violation at our values being violated in the public arena, right? If I care about, I used this example the other day, if I care deeply about human redemption, believing that everyone, nobody's a lost cause. Folks can't see your shirt, Laura, but it's essentially what your shirt is saying, right? Each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done.
That's right. comes from Brian Stevenson and Just Mercy.
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. And for me, what's at the heart of that as my value, and even as a Christian reinforcing that, is that every human can be redeemed. Everyone, not necessarily can be saved in the sort of colloquial sense of the term, but like there's nothing from which I can't come back. Mm-hmm. And when I bring that value into the public arena, the phenomenon of mass incarceration, the phenomenon of being shot first, asked questions later in a police stop, that violates my value. Like, you don't even know yet if I'm a criminal and I'm already dead. Like, you don't even know what my life could turn out to be, but you try me as an adult at 16 and you've cut off my chances of, you've arrested my development, mm-hmm. right? Of what I could grow into. How many of us were dumb at 16? 100% of us were dumb.
So dumb. I'll claim it for myself at least.
100% of us struggled.
I thought I knew it all.
Didn't we? I was telling my mama stuff. I just knew I knew all the things.
That's right.
But I made mistakes at that age, right? What if I had not been allowed to recover from those mistakes, right? What if those mistakes that I made when I was 16 were still being held against me, right? So now that I not only hold that value in my heart, I hold it in the public arena. And when I talk with other folks, I begin to connect myself and get connected to other people who share that value and the anger at it being violated. And then together in our shared interest, our shared self-interest, as we call it, in our group, we can now begin to act together and say, what can we do together? Well, we can push for a new way of looking at young people who are accused of committing crimes, right? Can we say, let's not transfer minors, young people, adolescents with adolescent brains into an adult system from which they cannot escape.
Right. Look at that history that we, that talked about making children predators.
That's right.
I mean, and naming and stigmatizing it and making it all the easier then to move them to be considered as, I mean, not even adults, but predator adults.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so part of what we're doing is, you know, how you watch the news and you feel helpless, you feel powerless. And to some degree, we've glorified that powerless feeling, mm-hmm. right? What can I do? So much bigger than me. You know, I'm just going to rosé all day. You know, no shade on rosé. I had some last night, but still, right? There's what MICA does for me and what we hope it does for Memphis and Shelby County is say, you actually have another choice. You could be powerful. You could build power, and not in the negative way that so many of us associated with, certainly I did years before I started in this work. With power over, with control, domination, with oppression, but that there's another kind of power. There's a collective power. There's a communal power. There's a power of values. And there's the power of our voices, our bodies, our resources, and bringing those to the table and saying, we will not stand for this violation of our values. We will not stand for being shut off from a full and abundant life, or from our children being shut off from that life, or our neighbors, right? And so as people of faith, as people of shared values, because not all the organizations that participate in MICA are faith-based organizations, but we share those values about human dignity, about equity for all, and about the power of redemption and the value of every human life. So those are the things that we're leaning into as an organization, into building that kind of positive, communal, collective power that can act for good in our communities, in our society.
It is a powerful thing to be present. I remember when we were all physically present at some of the town halls, mm-hmm. when we have our elected officials or their emissaries that they send to stand up, and MICA members asked to hold them, or they are asked to be held accountable for how they were voted in, what they said they would do, what they're not doing. And then are asking to regularly meet with them and staying firm on that, even when doors are closed and that does not happen as much as it could or should or needs to. But the accountability and the power that comes from a filled room, and this year it's been a filled Zoom, which is its own, you know, virtual good power, but power, you know, that's mobilizing voices. It's also mobilizing finances and money too. And when you put organized people and organized money together, things shift, positive power in that way. I was telling somebody, or writing about it. I can't remember. I've been doing a lot of writing these days. Cause I think it was through Micah that I was first shared that story about Mother Teresa, and just naming my bias and hearing, you know, when asked, you know, where do you think Mother Teresa in all her travels, would sit? And, you know, I just pictured her in the back of the plane, you know, and she was in first class. She was in first class. And why? Because that's where the power was. And that's where she wanted to be, right in the middle of it. And that's where the money was. That was the leadership. And, you know, if you're going to bring about change, you can't shirk from the powers that are, and you got to claim your own. And I just appreciate how that, you know, very short in stature little woman was so much bigger in the way she claimed her power. So I've always appreciated that.
She wasn't afraid to get in the ring, right? To be in the public arena, to fight those battles in a public way. And like you said, that doesn't mean shrinking back and playing small and quieting your own voice. This is about making sure that these voices of faith and values are loud and are heard and are present. And part of the discussion, we talk sometimes about politicians as though they're like a separate species. They're not, they're people we voted for who, as their best selves, are responsible to upholding the values that we want represented in the public arena. And so our job, our responsibility is to be there. Now, it may take an act of courage to get in there, but that doesn't mean that it's not the place we belong.
I heard something, where was it? I think it was on Being the other day, and I hadn't thought of this. Tell me your thoughts, that rage is always a part of courage. Built into the word courage. And I've been sitting with that and loving that in terms of just the indignation. You got to get angry, passionate, not necessarily violent, but there has to be a recognition of this is not okay. And I'm indignant. This is an audacity in a way that cannot go on. And I'm starting to really appreciate that word within the word. So what are your thoughts?
I like that. I hadn't heard that before, but I like it too. That it's in there. And that is another one of those terms that we need to reclaim as people of goodwill, as people of faith, as people of moral courage, to be able to say, it's all right to be angry. In fact, it's right to be angry. Some of these things should make us very angry. Yes. Children in cages should make us very angry, right? Like being shot before you have a chance to even defend yourself in a police stop, being arrested and held in jail, even for years before you have a chance to have a trial, that should make us angry. Yeah. And I just heard somebody say, in one of our national trainings, that sometimes we confuse humility with a powerlessness, with a holding back, with a playing small, with not being too emotional, right? But just, you know, I'm just going to hang back here. But they wanted to offer an alternate definition. No, humility is power under control. It's power under control. And I feel like rage fits in there, right? Like, doing this kind of work just requires focused rage, right? Rage that has direction and purpose, and has some action around it that's meant to bring about what's good, what makes us whole. And it's that thing that motivates us to not stay to ourselves. We talked about this just the other day in our meeting, not just us four and no more, but to get out there in the world and work for the good of all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You saying these good words makes me think about, and I believe it might be in our earlier conversation, you talked about a favorite scripture passage, Hebrews 10:39, believe in, not shrinking back, yes, moving forward. That's right. That is right.
Mm-hmm. I pulled it up because I wanted to read it at some point. And I'll tell you the context that I saw it in, but it's the quote is from Hebrews chapter 10, verse 39, but we do not belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved. And, you know, I had been through seminary. I had read the whole Bible, but that did not stand out to me until I was watching a movie called Boycott. That was sort of a biographical piece about Martin Luther King during the Montgomery bus boycott. And the scene where this scripture comes up, he's standing next to, I think it's E.D. Nixon, and E.D. Nixon's house is burning, right? The white supremacists have come and thrown a firebomb into his house in the night. And he manages to get out. You know, no one's in the house, no one is hurt, but the house is burning down. And E.D. Nixon is like, see, Dr. King, this is the part where I don't know if I can stay with your nonviolent plans, because I got a lot of rage, right? I got a lot of feelings right now. And I want to act them out. And Dr. King didn't really answer. He just gave him the scripture. But we don't belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but to those who have faith and are saved. And the way I heard that was that we are those who believe so strongly in the power of our convictions, that we are not willing to lose everyone for the sake of being right. We're not willing to be destroyed ourselves and to destroy our own values, in their case, being nonviolent, and lose ourselves. But we're going to be those who believe in our methods. We're going to believe in our work, and we're going to believe in our cause. And we will be whole. We will be whole. We will live with justice and dignity in this world. And their hate cannot stop us.
And Ayanna, if I may, that sounds also, I mean, naming all the tension, the hate, the struggle, it also still sounds so hope-filled. What do you think about that?
Yeah, some days I can access the hope and some days it's a struggle. Yeah,
absolutely, yes.
I had an incident recently. This is super small compared to all the things going on in the world. But a year or so ago, we discovered that my husband had never didn't remember to put the new tags on his car, on his license plate. Mm-hmm. So he'd been driving around, even though we'd paid up, with expired tags on his car for months. Wow. And when he figured it out and told me, I mean, we had a collective shudder, like so all this anxiety just tightening up in our chest, because had he been pulled over, then he just becomes another Black man who got pulled over, and who the hell knows what would have happened on that traffic stop, right? Maybe it would have went fine, maybe no drama, but that's not the world we live in. And yes, he has a law degree, and yes, he went to Morehouse, and yes, he's clean cut, and all those things respectability politics tell us will save us as Black people, but it's a lie. They are not going to ask for his degree, his diplomas, none of that stuff. When they pull him over, he's a Black man driving with expired tags. His life is just as at risk as any other Black man in that situation. And so that's the kind of stress, the kind of toxic stress that bubbles beneath the surface of just living every day as a Black person. Mm-hmm. So every day you can't find hope. Right?
No, not every day.
In that space. And that's okay, I think. I think this comes back to courage and faith being a decision, right? We decide not to be swallowed up in anxiety. We decide not to be swallowed up in despair. We decide, okay, today I'm going to choose hope. I don't owe the world hope. right? I don't owe the world a positive outlook, optimism, faith, but I choose it. Mm-hmm. I'm choosing it because I believe that's the powerful, most powerful way forward for me.
And if I may add, for me, I would say too, if I think back to those that have gone before and the legacy of those who have worked towards getting us to where we are and how far we still have to go, mm-hmm. but that legacy of those and the shoulders that we stand on, that to me resonates with hope when especially I'm feeling more hopeless, because it's not an everyday thing, but there's something about continuing on, especially knowing those that have gone before me.
That's right.
That legacy, that history.
Yeah. We think about our ancestors compelling. And what they believed for us, right? It's a Sweet Honey in a Rock song. We are. And the line is, we are our grandmother's prayers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We are our grandfather's dreamings.
Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Yes. And to know on whose shoulders we stand and to know that they had enough hope in what would be possible for us, even if they couldn't see it for themselves, that what would be possible for generations to come. And that's truly the hope that we fight with in Micah and personally for me and for my husband, and we fight for our hope that our children's lives will have more equity, we'll have more justice, we'll have more opportunity and access and potential than we experienced. And that is possible, that I'm just really choosing to believe God for abundant life. I'm choosing to believe that God meant that thing when he said, I've come that they may have life and have it more abundantly, mm-hmm. that the kingdom of God is within you, is within your reach, is accessible. That's where I'm really connecting with my hope, when I'm believing God for the future God has for us all.
It's in our bodies. It's in our gatherings. It's within our reach. It's palpable in Micah for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that gives me hope when things feel especially far away. I'll speak for myself on that. So
I'm into that.
What would you say, if I may move us right now, in terms of next and ongoing, but kind of concerns and upcoming projects? I'm thinking especially right now around Purvis Payne.
Yeah.
And the upcoming election with the district attorney. Mm-hmm. Things you want to share around that and some updates Micah-wise and such.
Sure. So this is a high energy and a high stakes time, it feels like. Obviously, not just for Micah, but for all of us, right? We're just out here trying to survive, out here trying to evade this COVID virus, the Delta variant. But also, there are longer fights that we're still in. We're still out here trying to figure out how we can have public safety that doesn't make Black and Brown people the default enemy. Right, that we all deserve to be protected and served. Trying to introduce a new narrative that doesn't lift up all the problems of our community and say that the solution is incarceration.
Right,
we're trying to turn those ships around. We're trying to make sure that our children have a chance to succeed. I was just reading some statistics yesterday about "quote unquote" learning loss, which. I'm thankful to be doing some reading that's given me some, that's challenging me to think differently about learning loss during the pandemic, because our children have not, maybe they forgot how to do a couple of math problems. Maybe they're a little bit behind in where we think they should be in terms of their reading level. But let me tell you this. These kids are more resilient and they know more about surviving a global pandemic than some of us have been able to manage.
That's right.
They have grown emotionally. Mm-hmm. They have grown relationally. They have grown in courage and strength and
resilience
oh, and mm-hmm. power and grit. I mean, these children have learned more in this last year than we should ever dare to call loss. It's different than what we anticipated they would learn. But they've learned a lot. So anyway, we want to make sure that those kids have, that all of our children have the best chance at achieving their dreams and living the adult professional lives they want for themselves, whatever that may look like. And we can't do that when only a quarter of our children are graduating high school ready for the next level of education, when they're not able to access trade and other vocational options when they get out of school because of housing or kids or the need for more income, right? And so we want to make sure our schools are working as well as they can and as well as they need to be so that our kids come out equipped to do and be who they want to be in the world. So for us, we're looking at education and making sure that bare minimum, our children can read and that they can read to learn and that they can read to question and that they can read to think critically. So we're leaning into making sure that our students in Shelby County Schools have the resources they need for literacy, have the resources they need for high school success, have the resources they need for even early childhood and career development. So what do they say? I'm not going to try and recreate it. Anyway, all of their years of growing up. But we're also, as you point out to the Purvis Payne case, we're looking at places where the justice system is not working for us. And you've heard this, I'm sure, a million times. I still believe that is true. The system was not designed to work for Black and brown people. It just wasn't. And so when it doesn't, we're not surprised, but we are determined to figure out another way and other realities, be them policies, procedures, practices that we can create or recreate so that they bring the justice that our lives demand. So with Mr. Payne, we want to make sure he gets a full and fair trial, right? That he gets all the evidence that belongs to his case introduced into the case and not lost, right? That we make sure that he gets the same rights that he would get if he were white. And I know people don't love to hear that, right? That
it's speaking truth, though, Ayana. It's speaking truth. It's not fair and equal. It's not.
It's not. And as Black people, sometimes we've seen the story so many times that it's easy even for us to forget that there could be another outcome. For us not to just shake our head and go, "That's a shame. They got another one of ours." Right? Like we don't have to accept that. That is a violation of our values in the public arena. And we can do something about it. We can ask for our district attorney to change policy, to introduce some new practices that would better ensure justice for all. We don't mean to, I shouldn't even say that. Some people do mean to be racist and some people don't. Some folks know what they're doing and some folks don't. I'm not concerned about whatever label you want to put on yourself. What I am concerned about is that if my black baby brother to my Black brother, Purvis Payne, goes through this justice system, that they get all the justice that they deserve. And the folks on the radio can't see me moving my
she's moving that finger around.
Mm-hmm. But listen,
we can hear it.
Right. It's in my voice. And whatever you can imagine, that's what I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. And so we do have an election coming up that we'll have judges on the ballot. It will have our district attorneys on the ballot. And those are the ballots that are most likely to be unquestioned, overlooked, forgotten. We'll forget to vote. And they're the ones where, you know, we vote with the least knowledge. Micah's trying to change that.
How is Micah trying to change that? How can people better learn about upcoming elections, for example, and be informed?
I'm so glad you asked. folks can learn through the Seeking Justice campaign that we have going on right now. If you go to Micah's webpage, micahmemphis.org, you'll be able to look for the Seeking Justice campaign and see a series of town halls to help us be more educated voters. But we're also not limiting this work just to ourselves. We've also been a founding partner of the Shelby County Voter Alliance, which is launching a voter academy, which will start later this month and will run through September, that'll help people get to know our elected offices, what they do, and when they're up, for elections and changes.
That's fantastic.
So we'll be able to learn through those. You know, we're partnering with that work. We're helping people whose voting rights have been lost through the incarceration process to be restored. Folks sometimes don't even know that that's possible, but it is. And so we and the Shelby County Voter Alliance are working together to raise awareness about that, but also to push on those places in the public arena, those decision-making places for the changes that we want to see.
Being informed is crucial, and knowing ways to be informed and get educated. This is one more way we're trying to get the word out. And Micah is certainly a big part in doing that. So, it's good to be in this work together for sure. I mean, everything right now with access to voting and voting rights, to being informed on upcoming elections, it's key. This is how democracy works when we're well-informed and use our voice.
That's exactly right. And let's not forget about the economy. And I apologize, Laura, for interrupting, but I want to make sure that we haven't forgotten that if you have to work all day, 16 hours a day, it might be tough to get away to vote, right? That right. These economic realities we're living with also impact our ability to participate in democracy in the public arena. And so we're concerned about those things, and we're working on eviction pieces. We're working on not just financial literacy, but financial access, making sure that everybody can walk into their local bank branch and walk out with a mortgage loan, walk out with a home repair loan for that 20-year-old roof, and so forth. And so we're working with Building Memphis. We're working with some local banks invested in that kind of restorative justice to bring about more access and finances for neighborhoods that have been racially discriminated against and disinvested as a result. So I want to make sure that I said that, because that's also important work we have going on.
It is. As we begin to start wrapping up our time, is it, tell me about ways that you would say to folks who are hearing us talk, are going to check out the website, micahmemphis.org, but want to become a partner, knowing that can't do it by as an individual, but maybe organizations that they're associated with, they want to be thinking about how can they find out, plug in more? What kind of next steps, just briefly?
Sure. And I'm glad you brought that up, and because it gives me a chance to add a caveat. We are an organization of organizations. It allows us to build on whatever structures your congregation, union, community, nonprofit already has in place, and use those to continue to build power. And if you don't have an organization that you're a part of right now that could join Micah, we still do welcome individuals to join us in the issue work. So if you want to join a task force that's working on any of these three pillar issues, econ equity, ed equity, race in the justice system, you can do that by coming and joining our issue night work. We come together every fourth Monday at 6 p.m. right now on Zoom to sort of come together and do task force work as a unit. And then in between meetings, task forces will meet individually. If you are part of an organization, congregation, and I want to shout out the Divine Nine or sorority or fraternity that would like to join Micah, you can come visit our delegates meeting. Now, the delegates meeting is open to all, but it's designed for the two delegates from every partner organization. So if you're interested in what partnership might look like within Micah and your organization, come check out that delegates meeting. That's a good first step. And everybody is also welcome to join the issue work. So the delegates meetings are on second Tuesdays at 7 p.m. And again, issue night is fourth Mondays at 6 p.m. Both of those meetings are taking place virtually until we can get some better COVID protocols in place to meet again in person. And so we look forward to seeing you there. And we have other things. If you just want to come to an action or join us in a petition drive or a signature drive, stop by. Like I said, the Seeking Justice page has some options for you, as well as micahmemphis.org/calendar, where you can see any and all of our upcoming events. We'd love to meet you, to start building those relationships, to have a one-on-one, and to be walking beside you in this work.
Awesome stuff. Thank you for your bright light, Ayana, and your good leadership. And it's a part of so many others, but I just want to name and honor yours this day. And loved this time and just carve it out as sacred. And I'm just thinking about how when people say Jesus wasn't political, Jesus was political.
Yes. I
mean, he was right there.
Deeply.
Right there in the public front, right there on the public forum, right there talking about how people matter and every voice counts and is needed. Mm-hmm. And systems that oppress need to stop and need to be broken down. So
crucified by the state, right?
Lynched.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Tell the whole truth.
Yep.
Well, thank you for having me, Laura. I really appreciate the chance to talk about Micah and to sort of explore together this particular way in which we live out our faith.
Honored to share in the journey with you and so many others, Ayana. Truly am. So thank you. You can listen to past episodes of Faithfully Memphis on Spotify or wherever you listen to your good podcasts. Please like and subscribe. And I guess I just need to say, this is Laura Geddes for Faithfully Memphis. Until next time, stay safe and stay positive and have courage.
Amen.